Well, Provost, Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Ron Hill, and I'm in the Political Science Department of Trinity College. It is my very pleasant duty indeed, on behalf of Trinity College, to welcome you to this Amnesty lecture, sponsored by the Irish section of the human rights organisation Amnesty International. This is now, henceforth, going to be an annual event from which will take place in Trinity College starting this year. Now, this is a new initiative for Trinity, not quite for Amnesty, but in order to launch this new initiative, we have with us, I think, one of the foremost liberal intellectuals of our day, Michael Ignatieff, who is Carr Professor of the Practice of Human Rights and Director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University in the United States. And I warmly welcome you and your wife, Susanna, to Trinity College. Now, to describe him as a polymath might be to underestimate Professor Ignatieff's accomplishments. He was born in Toronto, Canada. He studied in Canada, the United States, England, and France. He has been a journalist, and I think I first came across his name when he used to write articles in The Observer in Britain, sometime in the 1970s, I think. He still contributes articles and essays and reviews to a range of leading publications on both sides of the Atlantic and further afield. He has devised and presented radio and television series. He's published 3 novels, I think. He's published a family memoir, inspired by the fact that his father is Russian, his mother Canadian. He's published historical works, and he's published an acclaimed biography of the philosopher Isaiah Berlin. And for this, he was awarded the George Orwell Prize. In fact, the list of prizes that is either won or for which has been shortlisted is as long or longer than, in fact, the complete list of publications of a fair number of academics. But it is his scholarly studies of human identity and nation building and of the human conflict that is too often part of this that supremely qualify him to address us this evening. He has travelled in the war-ravaged Balkans, in Afghanistan, in Rwanda, to gain first-hand experience and insight into problems associated with conflict in the modern world, problems that are the real purpose of Amnesty's existence. In short, Michael Ignatieff is a challenging liberal thinker at a time when, for many people, the very word liberal is a term of abuse. He is also honest enough to scrutinize his own opinions, and even to change his mind over issues on which he has made strong public statements. Now, that kind of honesty and the sense of public responsibility that lies behind it, which in fact is a characteristic of the traditional Russian intelligentsia, is pretty rare these days, I think, when too often everything is seen as a kind of game in which principles are of little or no importance. We're fortunate indeed to have such a distinguished scholar and thinker to address us this evening. It is now my great honour and privilege then to invite Professor Michael Ignatieff to deliver the 2005 Amnesty lecture on the theme American Exceptionalism and Human Rights. Michael Ignatieff.
Thank you very much, Ron, for you travel very long distances for introductions like that. They may not be exactly accurate, but you bask in them nonetheless and don't feel disposed to correct their many inaccuracies and exaggerations. It's a great honor to be in this famous place of learning. It's a great pleasure to support one of the great human rights organizations of the world, Amnesty International. My subject is American Exceptionalism and Human Rights, and I'm going to define exceptionalism. I'm going to give you a typology of exceptionalism in a very earnest, standard American academic style. I'm then going to explain it and evaluate it. But many of you will have come to this audience thinking, what is exceptional about America is, in relation to human rights, that it is exceptionally bad. That is, what is exceptional about the United States is that it is essentially a rogue in relation to human rights and international law. The first thing I want to say to you is that I'm using exceptionalism to mean both exceptionally good and exceptionally bad. The puzzle that we have to explain is why the United States has been both a human rights leader and a human rights outlier. It's easy work to criticize it for being an outlier. Lots of countries are outliers. But this country isn't Libya. It isn't North Korea. It isn't China. We wouldn't have international human rights without the leadership of the United States. Don't forget Eleanor Roosevelt. Don't forget Franklin Roosevelt. Don't forget Jimmy Carter. And to get as controversial as I can, don't forget that the speech given by a U.S. president that most directly committed the United States to the promotion of human rights and democracy in the Arab world was given by George W. Bush. That is to say, whether you like it or not, whether you take the intentions at face value or not, human rights and the promotion of democracy is a central figure, a central feature of administration that many Europeans regard with unvarnished and unmitigated dismay. So the problem we have to explain together is why this great republic is a leader and an outlier, and that's what makes them exceptional. There are many outliers, there are very few leaders, and there's no one that is both a leader and an outlier in precisely this way. That's my problem. So if you come here with Noam Chomsky in your back pocket, I can't help you. I'm not talking about a rogue state. I'm talking about the leader of the free world and the extremely complex puzzle of its behavior. Okay. Let me then give you a typology of U.S. exceptionalism, the kinds of things that we would call exceptional. On the bad side. The first aspect would be what I would call exemptionalism. That is, the United States fails to sign up to international conventions and treaties and bodies like the International Criminal Court. It signs up and then fails to ratify the Genocide Convention. I think Bill Shabas is here and done a great leading study of genocide, and he will tell you that the United States took 30 years to ratify the Genocide Convention. So it's an outlier in that regard. It then commits to processes, and here I stray slightly from human rights into another field, the environment, and then refuses to ratify, Kyoto. Or it signs up, but signs up with reservations. The International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, the United States signed, but made reservations in respect of juvenile executions, executions of pregnant women, other reservations. Other countries do make these reservations, but the United States has a very long list of things that qualify its membership of the international human rights order. The piece of American exemptionalism, which has shocked the world, shocked many Americans, has been signing up to international conventions like the Torture Convention, like the Geneva Conventions, and then parsing them in ways that have shocked the conscience of many Americans, shocked the conscience of mankind. That is, parsing the Torture Convention to define torture in the words of one immortal and now happily infamous memo, to define torture as anything up to organ failure, right? The most single shocking memo by a public official in the United States that I've ever read in my lifetime. That is, you sign up to a convention and then you parse it almost out of existence. You sign up to the Geneva Conventions and you have historically an excellent record of compliance with the Geneva Conventions. The United States takes the Geneva Conventions very seriously. And yet, over Guantanamo, has parsed them, selectively applied them, denied the detainees at Guantanamo what is clearly mandated in the conventions, namely tribunal review of status. So this is exemptional forms of behavior. Now, the one thing, again, to make this as complicated as we can, is that exemptionalism and exceptionalism are not the same thing as unilateralism. Let's keep that distinction clear in our mind. Because the same country and the same administration that is parsing the Geneva Conventions and the Torture Convention in ways that I would be the first to criticize is also an enthusiastic multilateral partner in the battle against HIV/AIDS. Exemptionalism is not unilateralism. Sometimes this administration is unilateral, but at other times, in ways that don't get enough attention, it's a fully paid-up member of multilateral engagements like the Global AIDS Fund. Exemptionalism, self-evidently, is not isolationism. The current administration is one of the most engaged administrations in the world in the promotion of democracy and human rights abroad. You may not like it, but it ain't unilateralism, right? So we have a complex pattern that we need to try and understand. That's exemptionalism. That's the first element of American exceptionalism I want to focus on. The second one is much more familiar to you, and that's double standards. I mean, that's what, if Chomsky was here, that's what he'd be going on about. One human rights standards for its friends, Israel, Pakistan, another for its enemies, Iraq and Iran. That's one kind of double standard. Different standards for friends and enemies. The second kind of double standard is one standard for itself and one standard for the rest of the world. On the death penalty, for example, the United States is a complete outlier, again, as Bill Chavez has so importantly demonstrated, in an international consensus that is increasingly abolitionist. But the United States regards international standards on the death penalty as essentially irrelevant. So, double standards. It preaches human rights to the rest of the world and doesn't often comply with international standards at home. The third element of American exceptionalism gets much less attention, but is, I think, extremely interesting and important, and that relates to judicial behavior and judicial interpretation. There are a lot of any human rights meetings, there are going to be lawyers present. And whenever I start talking about the law, I start getting anxious because the lawyers are going to, they perk up. They rise from slumber. They fix me with their gimlet eyes. I am already in trouble. But anyway, I'm going to plow ahead and talk about the judiciary. One of the most important emerging aspects of globalization in the world has been the globalization of the law. There is, I think, here the distinguished ambassador of South Africa. She knows that the Constitutional Court of South Africa, as a matter of course, and I've seen them do it, when they have lunch in their lunchroom, I was privileged to be there, if you look in their library, there's German case law, there's French case law, they even, God knows, reach up to a Canadian case book, and I'm a Canadian, so I glow with pride. That is, they have internationalized the sources of judicial interpretation in South Africa. Their constitution, if I'm not mistaken, actively mandates that the Constitutional Court must refer to international legal precedent so as to make sure that South African jurisprudence is at a world standard. The Canadian Supreme Court does similar things. I'm sure Irish courts do the same thing. It is normative to refer outside your jurisdiction to international law, to the jurisdictions and decisions of other countries. The United States is an outlier in this respect. it's much, much more neuralgic and uneasy about citing international precedent. And you see this in the wars of footnotes conducted by rival Supreme Court justices in the United States. Justice Scalia will say, our job is to interpret the United States Constitution. International human rights, international law, what they do in Germany, what they do up north of the 49th among those benighted Canadians is none of my business. My job is to interpret the United States Constitution, and I need to maintain a coherent framework of interpretation that is American and derives from the intentions of the Founding Fathers. This shuts off the United States from a global legal conversation of increasing sophistication. But again, let's get this right. At the same time as you have a Scalia, you also have liberal justices saying, if we're going to look at the Texas sodomy law, we better look at what the sodomy laws are in the rest of the liberal democratic world and figure out how we can justify the fact that the United States Texas sodomy laws are eccentric in relation to evolving standards of international sexual practice and sexual conduct and regulation of same in the international arena. So the United States, the third aspect of American exceptionalism, it seems to me, could be called judicial isolationism or also judicial narcissism. That is, the narcissism that says we're the first great democratic republic of the free world. What do we have to learn from anybody else? There's an element of that in the Scalia thing. So those are the three elements of a typology of American exceptionalism that we need to understand. Exemptionalism, double standards, and what I'm calling judicial isolationism. Now let's move towards the second part of this lecture, which is to try and explain this pattern. Try and figure out why the United States behaves in this eccentric manner in relation to international human rights and international law in general. Because, as I've said, these exemptionist, double standards, isolationist practices go hand in hand with the most active democracy and human rights promotion in the world, passionate commitment to the principles of human rights. They have a stronger place in the rhetoric of American internationalism than almost any other country. And the whole fabric and structure of international law and international human rights would not exist without American leadership, presidential leadership, but also the leadership of great American scholars. Tom Bergenthal, Tom Frank, Lou Henkin, figures who, to the international lawyers, are canonical figures. So how do we understand this leader outlier pattern that I've tried to describe? I got four explanations. The first is geopolitical, is the simplest, and it takes you a long way. It's the biggest country in the world, the most powerful country in the world. The way to analyze American behavior is simply to analyze what it is rational in the national interest of the world's most powerful state to do in relation to international law, and if you do it that way, you can get a long way towards an explanation. It is rational for the United States to sign up to those parts of international law that leverage and increase its national interest. It is not rational for the United States to sign up to those parts of international law that constrain its sovereignty in any way. So the United States will sign up to the ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, because there's nothing in it, really. It doesn't constrain the United States as a sovereign state in any way. But it won't sign up to the ICC, the International Criminal Court, because that potentially draws American citizens and the American military into the dock of an international court over which they have no control. So you can understand the difference in their reactions to the two instruments. It's clearly defined by national interest. And this is a different set of calculi. This is an important thing to say in an Irish audience, I would say it in a Canadian audience, from the calculi of middle powers. I'm a Canadian, so we sign up to every international club going. Because if you're a middle power and you don't have much muscle, multilateralism is the game you have to play. It's in your national interest to multiply your multilateral commitments, even if it constrains your sovereignty, because it makes you a member of all the big guys' clubs. Ireland might do the same thing, although you have a historic history of neutralism, which gives you another set of perspectives. another set of perspectives related to your difficult national history and the history of your national independence. But for many middle powers, and that means Europe since the Second World War, multilateralism is not... What's slightly pious and slightly pompous, if I might say so, about European attitudes towards multilateralism is that you make it sound like God's work, when it's manifestly the national interest of these states. And it's manifestly less in the national interest of a superpower. That's my point. The calculations simply are different. So name-calling about this doesn't cut it. You're both working from the same principles, national interest, but coming to different conclusions, it seems to me. So that's how geopolitics can help us here. But geopolitics, or what the American political scientists call realism, also runs into a limit at this point. Because if it was all national interest, Franklin Roosevelt would never have got the United States to ratify the UN Charter. If it was only national interest, the United States would never have agreed to the substantial abridgments of its sovereignty, which to this day are an impediment on its sovereignty, namely the requirement of Security Council approval for the authorization of the use of force, which is where they came a cropper in Iraq. Why did the United States sign up to rules which do constrain its sovereignty? Geopolitics and realism will not explain that paradox of American conduct and behavior. And I think here you have to look at a second range of explanations that, for want of a better word, I'd call cultural. That is, the United States is a very particular national project. A country with a very, very strong sense that its history, the history of its freedom, the history of its creation, is of universal significance. That it is a political project of universal significance for the world. From the Pilgrim Fathers in the 1640s right through to George W. Bush, an authentic native language of American mission, which believes that the American story is of universal significance and a significance for export. That is to say, this is how it seems to me fundamentally human rights is understood in the United States. Human rights are not understood as international human rights. They're understood as American freedom universalized to the world. America's gift to the world. I mean, to some extent, this irritates the French not a little. It irritates the British not a little. It irritates the Irish not a little, since each of these countries have authentic national traditions of freedom. But for the Americans, the only country, due to its power, which has managed to universalize its sense of its own national political narrative as of universal significance. Now, the paradox, I think, of a cultural mission which says that human rights are simply American freedoms universalized to the world, is that human rights, international human rights, are for export but not for import. That is, the United States has a great lesson to teach the world, but it doesn't have very much to learn from the world, because it has the freedoms that all mankind conscientiously desire. This produces this deep reluctance to be judged by external standards, which it believes it authored in the first place and stands in no need of lessons from pesky Irishmen and difficult, pompous Canadians or anybody else. But it's very, very rooted in this sense of American national cultural mission. And there's another thing that's easy to dismiss and even to caricature. There's something much more important at the core of this, which is a doubt about the democratic legitimacy of international law itself, a doubt about its democratic legitimacy. That is, if the American experience is exceptional and distinctive in that it is the great project of freedom, that project of freedom is deeply legitimate to Americans because it is authored by them, created by them out of their national experience. International law and international human rights appears to be the creation of a lot of unelected, excuse me, lawyers working in Geneva somewhere, and lacks the lacks the grounded legitimacy of a democratic project. So it would be easy, ladies and gentlemen, if you could simply say, oh, the Americans have just got a superiority complex, which makes them indifferent to learn from others. The superiority complex is difficult to shake because it's tied to an idea of the democratic legitimacy of American rights culture, a sense that the only laws, the only rights that Americans will take with deep seriousness are those authored in its own constitution and its own national jurisprudence. Now, all countries have a bit of this, but no country has it quite like the United States. A third factor, which I think is less salient, more the domain of political scientists, but still important, are simply the distinctiveness of American institutions. And people neglect these institutional details, but they're important. The United States is more resistant to ratifying international law and international treaties and integrating into the international legal order because its institutions impose very serious obstacles to doing so. Federalism, for one thing. There are 50 states. It's very difficult to get national moral standards on an issue, for example, like gay marriage. It is just a nonsense to go to Americans and say, you've got to ratify some international convention on that regulates the laws regarding sexual conduct, sexual preferences, in a society where these are decided state by state by state. The state where I reside, Massachusetts, has gay marriage. That is anathema in Montana and Wyoming and will be for the indefinite future. There's absolutely no possibility of importing liberal moral reform of a high-minded kind through international treaty, because federalism imposes impassable barriers to that project in a way that's not the case in the United Kingdom, for example, or even in my own country, which has a different kind of federalism. The second element, which is, again, a boring institutional detail, but of great importance, is that the ratification of international law proceeds to the United States Senate, and you require a supermajority for ratification. It's just very difficult to ratify international law in the American institutional system. You've got to get two-thirds of the U.S. Senate to vote, which is why, you know, it took 30 years to get the Genocide Convention ratified. Simply institutional barriers were extremely important. There's another factor as well, which I think Europeans understand very poorly and need to understand, and Americans understand the European story very poorly. And that's if you stand back for a minute and ask the following question, how is it that Europe, the fons et origo of Westphalian state sovereignty, managed to create the most effective transnational, supranational human rights system, the European Convention of Human Rights and the European Human Rights Court, the only place in the world where a transnational court has the right to trump, revise, and force the revision of the domestic law of national states? It's the system in which you citizens of Ireland live and apparently live happily. How did Europe, which invented state sovereignty, manage to create a system where international human rights trumps in this way? The answer, the political scientists say, is the very, very terrible history of Europe. The great historians of the European Convention point out that when these tough-minded defenders of state sovereignty like the United Kingdom, France, and Germany sat down to think about how to stabilize post-war Europe, they thought the thing we need here is a human rights convention with compulsory force in all national states. Why? Because of German fascism, because of Italian fascism, because of Salazar's Portugal and Franco's Spain. The sense that the only way you could stabilize post-war European transitions to democracy is if you had a transnational European court that would keep these countries from rolling the great wheel of history backwards to horror, extermination, and death. And that historical experience has been the driver of one of Europe's proudest achievements, which is supranational human rights review of national legislation. But the minute you say that, you understand something about why the United States is exceptional. Because the United States has had no experience of domestic instability, domestic fascism, despite Philip Roth's powerful recent novel imagining Lindbergh coming to power and instituting a fascism at home. But it's known unbroken domestic stability since 1865. And that, it seems to me, makes it simply inconceivable for the United States to submit U.S. citizens to the authority of a transnational human rights institution of any kind. The histories are simply different. There's no point screaming at each other. We just are part of different, deeply different histories that need to be understood. Not even respected, just understood. Finally, I've given you some geopolitical national interest reasons. I've given you some cultural reasons. I've given you some institutional reasons. Let me give you some political reasons why American exceptionalism is rooted in the American political system. And here, these are things that are much more apparent to you as readers of the Irish Times or the BBC or listening to Livy O'Leary. And that is that the United States is the only country in the world with an important and ongoing and enduring interest group that is actively hostile to international law. It's an interesting fact. This hostility to international law used to be rooted in Southern segregationist hostility to human rights, refusal to ratify human rights treaties because they feared that Southern segregation would be drawn into the dock and subject to international condemnation. I mean, that's where a lot of the resistance to international law and international human rights comes from. It's very direct. It's Southern crackers, to be blunt. It's Dixie, right? Now, that's past. We regard that past with derision. We also owe it to ourselves to remember that one of the greatest human rights struggles for freedom in the 20th century struck it down. When I teach my students what a human rights campaign looks like, I give them Martin Luther King's speech on the courthouse, Alabama courthouse steps in 1964. That's the language of American freedom. So we've got the crackers, but they never forget the language of American freedom, because it's helped to free the world, as our South African friends will tell you. But set against that American language of freedom has been a very stout, ideologically rooted resistance to international law, which now has unusual strength and authority in the current Bush administration. A doctrinal opposition to international law, which uses this argument, which is an important one. Why should the United States obey laws which its citizens have not authored? The fundamental critique addressed by this political majority to the status of international law by John Bolton and ideological figures in the current Bush administration is this stuff isn't democratic. We shouldn't obey stuff that we haven't authored. And that, it seems to me, is a challenge that has to be met and addressed. Okay. I've done my best job at trying to explain American exceptionalism. I am coming to the end of here. Let me evaluate it very briefly. First question to evaluate, is this a lasting or passing phenomenon? The provost referred before we came down here to human rights being an aspect of globalization. And that's true. If that's true, then you might argue that, for example, the American judicial isolation, the refusal to join the global conversation about law, is going to be broken down. I mean, as America is drawn into a globalized international order, its resistance to international law is going to diminish. That's the best case you can make. That is, that it's a passing phenomenon. Opposition to international law was rooted in Southern segregation. As Southern segregation passes, America begins to have a conversation with the rest of the world. My view, however, since I put tremendous emphasis on the doubts addressed to the very legitimacy of international law by the democratic argument, and I think that democratic argument is tremendously strong, and that leads me to think that this is not a passing phenomenon. Globalization is not going to sweep this stuff away. The doubts that Americans have, conscientious, good-hearted Americans have about the legitimacy of international law, are going to continue. As long as America is the primary power in the world, as long as its power is what it is, I think exceptionalism is a permanent feature of America's relation to the international order. Now, let me ask then two questions and then conclude very quickly. What cost does the United States pay? Does the United States pay for American exceptionalism? And I think that's one of the interesting ways to think about the Iraq story. Most of you know I supported the war in Iraq, and I'm happy to talk about that later, although my children say, always urge me to say, it's not about you, Dad. This is not about me. But what the operation in Iraq shows is the tremendous diplomatic, political, and economic costs of exceptionalism. That is, I've tempted to make, in a sense, a case for it, to say it's rooted in a doubt about the democratic legitimacy of international law, but there's simply no doubt when you look at the costs that unilateral exceptionalism has imposed on the pursuit of American national objectives, you begin to get a pretty powerful argument that this kind of exceptionalism, whatever its rationale, whatever its basis in argument, is imposing huge costs in the United States. There's just one headline on this, which you all know. The 1991 Gulf War, to throw Saddam out of Kuwait, cost the United States almost nothing because it had UN Security Council approval and other nations basically paid for the cost of the US-led military coalition. Flash forward to the second Iraq War, the cost is $300 billion and mounting. I mean, it's just that direct. If you don't have international law behind you, if you don't have legitimacy, it imposes huge transactional costs to the exercise of American power. And Americans simply need to think about that. When I am asked by administration officials, you know, give me an argument to make us less exceptional, that's the one I use. It's going to cost you. It is costing you. It will cost you ever more. Okay. The second question, which is more relevant to you, as inhabitants of an important middle power in countries like my own Canada, is what cost does the rest of the world pay for U.S. exceptionalism? And here I want to make a point, which is that it's obvious that the cost that the international community plays is that U.S. resistance can slow down the emergence of international institutions. It's hobbling Kyoto. It's slowing the emergence of an international criminal court. It's delaying a lot of pieces of international architecture that many of us believe are necessary for the development of some kind of global order to prevent this from becoming, as Anthony Giddens said, a runaway world. We don't want a runaway world. We want a world that is governed and ordered. American resistance to international institutions is slowing that project down. But notice what I'm saying. It's slowing it down. It's not stopping it. My view is that for all the loose talk about American imperialism and the American empire, and God knows I've encouraged some of this in loose talk of my own, the signal fact that all middle powers have to be aware of is this: the cost of saying no to the United States is going down, not up. My country, Canada, wouldn't have anything to do with the Iraq War, has paid very little price. France has paid a price for its conduct in the Security Council. But the cost of saying no to the United States is actually going down. Countless numbers of countries were bullied and harassed by the United States, Chile, countries in Africa, to lend their support to the Security Council vote and didn't give it, and haven't. If this were a truly imperial world under American domination, all of these people would have been systematically punished. The reality of our world, despite American hegemony, and I'm not trying to palliate or forget American hegemony, is that the cost of saying no, the cost of resisting, the cost of defying the United States, is going down, not up. So when I'm talking in my own country of Canada, I say things like this. It was good for us to recognize China when the United States wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. It was good for us to recognize Cuba when it drove anti-Castro Cubans nuts in Florida. It was good for Canada to support the ICC, the Landmines Treaty. In other words, the world we're living in is a world in which there's plenty of room for Irish leadership, Canadian leadership, British leadership, French leadership, German leadership, Indian leadership, Brazilian leadership. The idea that we should all sit here bitching, excuse my language, about the United States and waiting for them to fix it seems to me completely fallacious misunderstanding of the very real power that middle powers have to shape and form a better world. Yes, exceptionalism is a problem, but frankly, it's only going to be fixed within the American domestic context. You've got to remember that there are 35 million Americans who basically voted for John Kerry because they want a more multilateral, liberal, internationalist, engaged, rule-abiding America. That's what they voted for. They lost. They're not going to lose indefinitely. If you forget that this is the country that gave us the UN Charter, you will have given up on the United States, and that, it seems to me, is a mistake. But most of all, and this is my concluding thought, don't give up on yourselves. The great reigning illusion everywhere I go is that the number one problem in the world is American power. My judgment is that the reigning problem in the world is a misplaced sense of our own impotence. And that we can fix. Thanks for your attention.